Yeah. About the restaurant. So I came with my wife here and our daughter, Kenza, she was 4 or 5 years old. In 2006, I came to do my PhD at SFU. And like a year or so after our arrival here, we started to notice that the absence, the invisibility of Palestinian culture. Most people we know or we met, we talk to, you know, their knowledge about Palestine comes from mainstream media, basically, or, you know, maybe a little bit more than social mainstream media, but still it's very limited. And it's very political knowledge about our culture. So myself and Tamam, we decided we want to do something that extends Palestinian culture here in Vancouver. And we both artists. Tamam is also a visual artist. She's a painter, actress, and she was a TV hostess in Palestine. So, you know, we're always like, we come from the arts and spend all our life, like, I did nothing but work and I was teaching and making films in Palestine and writing. So all our lives we were working in culture. However, we're not business people, like we don't have a background in business really, but Tamam is a really good cook. Mm-hmm. Like, she just, like, the way she paints, so you give her any ingredients and she can tend them, make fascinating things, you know. And she loved, I mean, we, you know, after we married, we lived together, and little by little I started to realize her creativity in cooking. She never manifested it really. She always liked talking. So here in Vancouver, actually, we decided that maybe the best to open a restaurant to do food, introduce food. But the whole thing, like, we until now, if you look at the restaurant, it's like a gallery, really. It's like we show our food, but also all the artwork here is the man's artwork on this wall.
Really,
my artwork and the other wall inside. Gosh. So this painting also, like a Mexican artist with the man, and we painted. So we maintain like our interest in the arts, uh-huh. And you know, now it's like a gallery of food and art. So we learned really so much about food, things that I myself never thought about. I never like really took. I mean, in Palestine, I thought about food when I got hungry.
Yeah.
That's all really, but I never theorized food, or maybe I should have, but here, you know, we just learned, I learned like how food is amazing in terms of communicating one's culture to another culture. It's amazing, like, you know, I spend my life, most of my life, as I mentioned, I'm a filmmaker, writer, teacher, so I'm always talking to people about Palestine, whether poetry, film, or any other intellectual capacity, but like, you know, and always people listen and they interact and things, but they always like filter what you say. They people come with their languages, their backgrounds, their many things, right? And they have to like think about what you say. They like it, they don't like it, they agree, they don't agree, you know. But with food, there isn't this problem. With food, people eat if they like your food. Oh my God. This is Palestinian food, yes.
Yeah.
Wow, this is fascinating. So it really builds a relationship.
It does.
That is not intellectual, but bodily or physical relationship, because the food goes inside the body.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. You don't think about it.
Yeah.
And it becomes, so they become more open, susceptible to learn about Palestine. The conversation can go in any direction. And it works, like it really works in terms, and food, you know, like talking about food is not only talking about eating, but talking about cooking, about harvesting, about where the food comes from, about geography, about history. Food takes you in so many, about memory and about community, you know, since October 7th, you know, because it's an authentic Palestinian restaurant, and we are two proud Palestinians, not, you know. Before October, because since we came, we are proud of our culture, we're two proud Palestinians, and we practice this and say this every day, you know, we're not shy about it, we're not afraid from it. But we noticed also like how eating Palestinian food in the last 2 years became there is an added value.
Okay.
You know, when people come to eat, it's like they come to eat, they talk about the food, they talk to us. This place has become a cultural hub, a cultural center where people come to express their solidarity with Palestine. You know, even by eating Palestinian food, a lot of people like, we get like now, the way we get our food, our catering orders, most 90% of the catering orders, there's no other food we would like to share with our whoever, but Palestinian food. And I know not because we're, just because of the general environment and people feel like there is an added value, moral or ethical or political value to doing business with Palestinian food that they already like the food. So
I mean, it's kind of also like making a stand too. It's supporting your business, it's supporting Palestine in general.
Exactly.
Especially, yeah, since you've done a lot for Palestinian activism as well. Yeah, you guys had like that fundraising event last year in like January, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was also looking through like your social media as well. You've been raising awareness well before the October 7th
event. All our lives, since we're... I mean, this is the destiny of any Palestinian intellectual or artist, that you are really, because of our situation and the political realities of our life. So you cannot really, we don't have the pleasure, we don't have the luxury of thinking outside of our issues. You know, like I made films, and I always said, like, I would love to make a film about something that is not political or doesn't have political ramifications or manifestations, but I am incapable of making anything or write a book or that doesn't deal with my existential realities. I am incapable of doing this really. So yes, everything we do, you know, whether my films, my writings, it's all has to do with Palestine and with our what we're going through.
There's that wave.
Yeah.
Although you guys cover a lot of information about Palestine, things that normal, I guess, media outlets that I or like my peers usually rely on is not covered by the things you guys are showing there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we have a, you know, we have a, because we lived all our lives in Palestine, so we grew up there. And when we speak from there. You know, we know our families are there, our friends are there, our communities are there, our hearts are there. But also, we're not like politicians. We're artists, and artists are, you know, usually creative, supposedly creative people who come up with creative ways to express things different. Even like, you know, I much prefer artists talking, doing politics than politicians doing politics, because it's nuanced, accentuated. This is like, and I think, yes, the things we touch, the things we talk about, the things we see, and the way we see things that are happening in Palestine, you know, it's very personal. We grew up, we're both born in the old city of Jerusalem. Tamashi grew up in the old city of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a refugee camp outside of Jerusalem. My personal story, for example, as a Palestinian refugee, my parents were living a beautiful life in their home, and they were like landowners, and they traveled 3-4 times a year, even back in the 20s and 30s. Suddenly they woke up and someone else taking their home, and they found themselves in a tent, that only the shoes in their feet, nothing, you know. So this is a tragedy, this personal tragedy, it's intergenerational tragedy, it's not the tragedy of our parents only, you know. We Palestinians, all of us suffer from intergenerational trauma that really, you know, what just, you know, from our parents and what happened to them. But also, you know, we are people of conviction because we know what happened to us is wrong, what happened to us is unfair. Mm-hmm. We're just asking for our homes back. You cannot be more determined. I'll tell you what. I was born in 61. When I was about 1961, the West Bank. So Palestine was occupied, or part of Palestine was occupied in 1948, right? West Bank from 1961 until it was reoccupied in 1967. From 1948 to 1967 was under Jordanian rule. Gaza was under Egyptian rule. So we were so scattered. There were no connections, like not phone, no letters, no nothing. You cannot talk to each other. So we were very fragmented. So my father, when the Zionists occupied the rest of Palestine, so we were living under Jordanian rule from 1948 to 1967, right? Uh-huh. Now, in 1967, the Israelis occupied Gaza and the West Bank. So now all of Palestine became under Israeli occupation. Before that, like, we are in the West Bank, I couldn't go to Jaffa or Haifa or Gaza, everybody. You cannot move. Mm-hmm. After 1960, because it's all under one occupation, we could move now. Every parent did. Those who left, were forced to leave Palestine, took their children to see their homes, their former homes. So my father took us, all of us, the children, to his home in the village of Safriya, where he was kicked out in 1948. The home was still there, green, light green, big house, orchards, citrus orchard in front of it, and we stood there, and my father, like, he recognized there was a clay water jug, big ones. Villagers, they used to put water in them because it stays cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he was showing us the house. Then a woman, a Jewish woman, comes out from inside the house and she speaks Hebrew with my father. They exchange a few words. She goes back inside. She comes back and she wants to give my father some oranges. He refused to take them. Yeah. But all I could see, tears in his eyes. So that really, that event when I was about 7 or 8 years old informed the rest of my life, informed me, my character. This was the most traumatizing event that I have ever lived. And till now, I can never forget it. Till now, I can never step outside of the reality that was presented to me by seeing someone else living in my, in our home. With no repercussions. They just stole the home and they live there, and we are refugees. We don't have a home, we live under a tent. This reality really shaped my, a lot of who I am today. You know, how I think about justice, how I think about the world, how I think about equality, how I think about freedom, how I think about so many things. And the way I see, like, the Palestinian problem, or I see so many things, you know, I am informed by this event.
I feel like most people around me always assume food as, like, just a source of sustenance. Oh, I need to eat food.
Yeah, right.
But you have this interesting take on how food's relevant as a symbol almost.
Absolutely.
Like, political resistance.
Look, for example, to give you an example, look how much of the... Look, what happened to the Palestinians? Mm-hmm. Or what's happening to the Palestinians have happened to the indigenous people here in North America. Their land was taken away from them, their mountains, their rivers. It was genocidal policies. They tried to get rid of them, residential schools. They forbid them to speak their language. They put poison in their blankets to kill them. They soaked them with alcohol and drugs to try and make them miserable and get rid of the Indian people here. But they did not, they could not. Now, if you go back and you see what really sustained the indigenous culture and the indigenous identity. Food at the core of the whole thing. Their cooking, their harvesting, their gathering, their fishing, the way they sit and they, the weeks they take to dry the fish and to smoke the fish, the stories they tell, the fact that they eat together, what they do together is communal. It's the production of memory together. That really what sustained their sense of identity and the stories they told. Stories narrate us. Stories narrate us. Stories are also, they become like lighthouses, our narrative, lighthouses that guide us. We tell stories, we remember stories. Food in Palestine, you know, it's communal. We eat together, we harvest together. It's like, I really only when I left to study in New York, I discovered like, food as a commodity that you consume, and food is like a sign of status, that where you eat and how much you pay, in what restaurant you eat and with whom you eat, switches the state of eating in North American culture now. You know, people sit down before, like before, in the old times we used to pray. People used to pray well, before they eat. Now they take pictures, just to stress the fact that this fascination, this visual culture, and this gratification, personal gratification that we get from eating. So eating has become less and less communal, less and less in an infrastructure that reproduces communities and their memories and their stories. Now it's like sexualization of our culture. It became really just a personal thing that gratifies the person who eats, you know, and Uber brings you the food from wherever, and you know. So food for us is not really just about consumption or about the nutrition, really. No, food, as I said, is a site upon which we reconstruct our sense of identity. We gather, we remember, we tell stories, we remember stories. Food connects us to our geographies, to connects us to our ancestors. You know, most like the food we serve here at the restaurant, frieke. I mean, frieke, like you mentioned the word frieke, I can see my father, my grandfather, my grandmother. I can remember the road to my grandmother's house and where they used to dry the frieke. You know, this is the beauty of it, that it really, food takes you in so many directions, but connects you to your land and to your history and to your ancestors. That's the beauty of food. And that's why I think, this is why also, we Palestinians, we didn't really understand, not only me, but many of us, we take food for granted. Right? You never think like that. But only when you are forced to, when someone else come take hummus is ours, hummus is Israeli. This is Israeli. This is not your food. This is not. And you become like, oh, okay. You know, little by little now, so many Palestinian young enthusiasts or cooks, they treat food not only as a commodity that we eat, but a cultural substance, cultural material that can help reconstitute our existence and our sense of identity.
Yeah, yeah. I was not aware Israelis were taking your food, though. That's insane.
Well, I mean, it's, yeah, not only our, like, you know, when they come and they change the names of the street, change the names of all archaeological sites, change the names of all the towns and villages, mm-hmm. kick you out and tell you don't exist, your culture don't exist, you don't have a history here, you know, you don't exist. You are facing somebody who, like, kill you, then they say you did not exist. So how do you fight them? You fight them with your connection to the land, you know. You fight them with, you know, the narrating beyond words that you have thousands of years of history. You can see it in my food, in my, you know, in many things we do here in this country, in this land. I have not really, like, I know the writings about food and colonialism, food and identity, food and many things, but, you know, still it's an understudied field. But it is a very vibrant and very worth studying, honestly. And the things, again, like, I really never, like, learned so much just from having this restaurant here and doing food and talking about food with people and doing food with the purpose of culture, not money. So that, you know, helps us a lot in understand a lot more about food. Well, the restaurant, it's been honestly a successful story. Like from 2012 when we started, it wasn't a restaurant, it was a cafe. They didn't have like the equipment or anything. So we built it little by little, and until now it's a Class A restaurant, mm-hmm. and with very loyal clientele. A place where we provide a safe space for the community to gather, for people who, our logo or what we say in our Instagram, like, may our food be a bridge that connects you further with Palestine. That's really what we want to do, and I think to a great extent we succeeded. Creating this bridge that connects people with Palestine, and especially in the last 2 years, you know, as you mentioned, we did the fundraisers, we did a Mother's Day fundraiser that was a musical event here in Vancouver last May. so that people in the community feel that we have created a space, an authentic space, that two Palestinians and a Palestinian restaurant, and we create, you know, we're not afraid, we're not shy about it. Sometimes people from the community, activists, or we give them the space to use on Mondays because we are closed. They can do embroidery. They can do other activities, and they fundraise. They do, starting next month, every Monday, first Monday of the month, we have a poetry salon.
Ooh.
And I tell you, poetry is amazing. Like I as I mentioned, I wrote poetry when I was, my first creative activity was writing poetry. And I wrote some of the most, I would say most popular or famous songs came from Palestine. I co-wrote some of those songs.
Ooh,
yeah,
wow.
That's like 30-something years ago. So, and I really like, also, poetry re-emerged during the last 2 years as a very vital, vibrant way of communication. People come and they come and leave donation and with a poem. We come to open the restaurant and found people put poems under the door. Poetry was a great deal of the communication with people, how people interacted with us through poetry. So we did a couple of poetry readings, and they were just beautiful. So now, and more poets. And I tell you what, the first theme of the poetry, our first poetry meeting, the theme is a poetry of resistance. We're going together, Palestinian, indigenous, and South African poetry. So these are three communities of people who grappled with settler colonialism, you know, too. So we want to see how, through poetry, how these three communities of people dealt with settler colonialism and how they brought it through their poetry. So we're going to do this, and maybe 1 week to 3-4 weeks until we like just go through. So every time we're going to have like a theme around which like we invite poets to come and audience to come. And we do it on Monday when the restaurant is closed. And it's a free event for everybody.
Yeah. For any listeners who are interested, where could they find us?
Our Instagram.
Oh,
our Instagram for Palestinian cuisine. Yeah, our Instagram will be, we're in the final stages now. Soon we'll be announcing the first poetry salon. And in addition to this, we are planning in the very near future, we're going to do a film festival that also focuses on communities. We're going to bring films and filmmakers and panel discussions that bring together indigenous Palestinian and South African films and filmmakers and artists. And we're going to do food, dance, and film, but mostly we're going to focus as a film festival. But the idea is to really, there is a lot, you know, common and shared experience, shared realities, but yet there is a lot of differences between these communities. And the only way we can bridge those differences and learn and, you know, communicate these shareable values, these, you know, the struggle, the resistance, is that the more we create activities together, language, images, writings, paintings, films that speak the truth of our existence, the truth of our experience, we create language and more vocabulary for future generations to make it more easier to grasp the realities of those communities. And we can do this only by creating more and more activities. So poetry, film, and I'm a believer in art. I believe in art more than I believe in God, really, or religion. And I believe in the efficiency of art, freeing our minds and our hearts, you know. Yeah.
If any listeners interested, you guys could find them at 2616 Hastings Street, mm-hmm. I think?
Yes.
Yeah. And they're open Tuesdays to Saturdays.
We are open Tuesday to Saturday at 5 p.m.
Thank you guys for listening. And thank you again to Shelby for joining me.
Anytime, Florentine. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you and SFU and the students at SFU. We did, all the best to you. And the only thing, you need to come and eat the food here, try our food. Make you bring your family with you.
Once again, thank you so much to Flo as well as Sobi El Zobayadi of Tamam Fine Palestinian Cuisine for that interview. Really amazing stuff. And again, Tamam Fine Palestinian Cuisine is on East Hastings Street in Vancouver, BC. So go check it out. It looks like not just for food, but for also poetry events and other community events going on there. You can find that at their website, tamam.ca. Before we get into the end of this hour, here's a bird note.
This is Bird Note. The Lewis's woodpecker's glossy dark green back, red face, and pink belly make it look as if it belongs in a tropical forest. But this species is, in fact, an icon of the American West. A temperate migrant, this bird breeds across the western states in mature ponderosa pine forests, and then moves south in winter. A century of logging and fire control has taken its toll on these mature pine forests, the preferred nest site for the Lewis's woodpecker. It takes a long time for a ponderosa pine to grow large enough for the woodpecker to carve out a nest cavity. As nest holes have become scarcer, so have many other species that rely on them. For example, the tiny flammulated owl has also declined. The moths that make up its diet are absent during northern winters, so it is highly migratory, wintering in Mexico and Central America. Thus, its fate is also tied to the health of tropical habitats. But there is hope. Lewis's woodpeckers also nest along rivers in large cottonwoods, trees of little value for timber. Furthermore, many remaining tracts of old-growth ponderosas are protected on public lands, and the trees are growing larger as we speak. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
For one final time, we are back this hour with Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This has been your host, Danny Nesvedarani. Thank you to every single person who contributes to Speak Up here at CJSF. Thank you to Flo for that amazing interview. Thank you to Pam Hassan from CICK News for her piece on the affairs of Kitimat Council. And thank you all for listening this hour. Before Democracy Now, right at 11, I'm going to be ending off with one last track. This is High Roller from Sour Dope. Thank you for tuning in.